Welcome to Double Take, critical, sometimes confrontational, always amusing conversations about movies. Double Take is a Cinema Classics production, hosted by Johnny DiLoretto and John DeSando. I'm Johnny DiLoretto.
I'm John DeSando.
We're doing our double take here.
It is.
We're going to do a double take.
Oh, boy.
On the great Sean Connery.
Oh.
We have to talk about this guy. Yeah. First of all, let's start. I want to ask you, I love Sean Connery.
Yep. In fact, you named one of your kids.
My son, my youngest son's middle name is Connery.
Yeah.
I just think that's cool.
Yep.
And I wanted to give him that sort of a gift of, he won't know Sean Connery, you know what I mean? He won't grow up knowing what that means, but it is ineffably cool. And it was a little gift that I bestowed him. Yeah, Sean Connery has meant a lot to me over the years. He was my dad's James Bond, and so by extension, my first exposure to James Bond. But what are some moments? Let's start with Bond. For you, what are some of your favorite Sean Connery moments as James Bond?
Dr. No is one of my favorites. And I, you know, I can't. And From Russia with Love, is a favorite of mine, and that was his favorite role, or his favorite Bond
of the
film,
Bond movies. Yeah,
of the Bond movies.
It's often considered the best one because it, you know, solves the problems of Dr. No without quite getting into the gadgetry of Goldfinger.
You know what I wanted to ask you is the characteristics of Sean Connery, what he brings to this role that makes him the definitive Bond. What is it about this actor? Now, I'm a firm believer that choosing the right actor is a great deal of the success of your movie.
Yes. I want to say it's brute sophistication.
Nice. Very nicely said.
Coupled with the just unforgettable, almost hypnotic magnetism he possesses. His eyes, the lines of his cheeks.
Yes.
His eyebrows,
yeah.
His stature, and the way he moves. You know, it's legend that Connery studied supposedly the movement of panthers in order to nail down James Bond's swagger. It was a clip of this, like that they that the Broccolis saw. Before they didn't screen test him. They saw this and cast him sight unseen based on that alone.
Because there were originally, even from Fleming, there was an interest in having Cary Grant do it.
Yeah, which he would have been too old at the time.
But let's say that he was the right age. I think he would have been a good choice.
He would have been. He was in his earlier days physical. You know? He had the acrobatic background, the gymnastics background. You're right. I don't know that Cary Grant, though, could have pulled off the menace. I don't think there's a moment in Cary Grant's impressive filmography where he convincingly portrays brute menace the way Connery could.
Right. Very good.
Now, you know, you could see, if Cary Grant had taken on Bond at the right time, you would have gotten a much more Roger Moore-ish type of Bond from the outset.
And taking a little bit too much irony with it, a little bit too sardonic. That's what I always complained about with Roger Moore, though I loved his asides and his snarky approach. It became too much.
Yeah.
That was the whole rule.
I will say, though, Grant's, the way Grant was with women on screen, and I recently read a Pauline Kael assessment of Cary Grant, which is really, she does a really beautiful job of describing his chemistry with some of his best female co-stars. And it was that he was always equal with them. He was always on par with them. Not in the way that Clark Gable was domineering. Cary Grant wanted a playmate, not a, you know, he wanted somebody he could banter with, somebody on equal footing. And that certainly, at least in those first, you know, couple of decades of James Bond, that wasn't how James Bond was.
I wonder for Grant if that was because he was bisexual. I wonder if that brought a little bit to that role.
A little bit more of
a... You're making me think that way anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. I also have to tell you, you asked me, and then I'm going to ask you, of Connery's other roles, I have to say I love The Man Who Would Be King.
Yes.
His role in that.
Right. Cast opposite his good friend Michael Caine.
Oh, my. What a great film.
In a movie directed by John Huston. Oh. What a great classic adventure film. Full of, you know.
I always remember the way he says the name. He says Peachy. I think he's good.
Peachy,
right. Yeah. Only he could say it.
Right.
But there, it was his favorite role of all that he had played.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good example. But now your favorite of all of his James Bond?
Oh, my favorite of all the James Bond movies are, you know, there's so many great moments in a lot of them, but certainly those first three. The moment when, in Dr. No, when one of the villains sneaks into his hotel room and thinks he's got the drop on him and unloads his gun into the pillows in the bed, only to have Bond turn the light on, and he turns around, and now the guy's unarmed. And Connery says, "You've had your six." And then he just unceremoniously shoots the guy dead. It's important to note, I think, that at the time, that was a shocking kill. That our heroes didn't kill unarmed men. Now, the guy was armed, but he had spent his bullets. It's the casual, heartless, slick way that he does it. You know he's justified in doing it, but there's something, that's the menacing part.
Oh, well, listen, you're reminding me, that was the first time I think that I can speak for many people in the audience, actually realized what 007 meant. You were free to kill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a license to kill.
Yeah.
And that had been said. That moment that you're talking about was the moment I realized it's true.
Yeah, you don't have to weigh any options. You just do it. Yeah. You just dispatch the guy. Yeah, I loved that. And of course, you know, the one-liners. When I was a kid, I loved how he gets in a fist fight, throws the guy in the bathtub, and then the heat lamp in after him.
Oh, yes!
And he says, "Shocking," you know? And one of my favorite ones that's really subtle, two of them, I got to give you real quick. And from Russia with Love, there's a guy climbing out of a window on the side of a building, and there's an advertisement painted on the side of the building so that the guy is climbing out of a woman's mouth, and his cohort shoots the guy, and he falls to his death, and Connery says, "She should have kept her mouth shut." That one is great. And then I forget which one it is. He's gambling, and he asks a girl what her name is, and she says, Plenty O'Toole. And he says, "Named after your father, no doubt."
Yes. And then do you remember his response when he finds out one of the ladies is Pussy Galore?
Oh, yeah. He says, "I must be dreaming."
And that was another moment where we realized that movies were changing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, with a name like that, how do they dare? And he
the
delivered
innuendo,
it.
The winking, knowingness. You know, the other thing we got to talk about, because we didn't get to this on Cinema Classics or Remembrance of Him, is as a fashion icon.
Yeah.
The guy just looked stunning.
I know.
Even when he wore ridiculous things like the terry cloth jumper in Goldfinger.
Oh, God.
You know, the powder blue jumper.
Oh.
You tell me that guy doesn't look great in it.
I know.
We're all looking at it thinking it's silly. It's only silly because we'd look ridiculous in
it. Well, look, one of the things about him is that he was, prior to all this, he was a bodybuilder. So that he did not have a weak body. He had a strong body. He was a great 6'2".
Mm-hmm.
He had so much going for him. He was thin.
Yeah.
If just physically he had it going for him, but that the inside, that ability to project, you use the word in our cinema classes, insouciance.
Yeah.
That kind of, he doesn't care.
Yeah.
You know,
and yet he does, you know, hold on, we got to say this, that you're listening to Double Take, critical, sometimes confrontational conversations about movies with your hosts, Johnny DiLoretto and John DeSanto, talking about Sean Connery. You know, what? Where did we just leave off? What were you saying? Oh, the insouciance. He also, that I think really early on as a kid, I picked up on this thing that hooked me into what Bond was all about. That there was this kind of devil may care, but not offhandedly so. This attitude where he knew he might die. I he knew he could die, but he wasn't going to give them the satisfaction of dying. That, and somehow his fight to survive was based on duty to country, but also this, I'm just not going to give up. I refuse to quit. I refuse to succumb to this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it wasn't this overly confident thing. You know, you would see Connery sweat. I love that about him. You know, when the laser beam is going up between his legs.
Yes.
Or he was nervous. Yeah. You know, at the end of Goldfinger, when he's trying to disarm the bomb and the clock is ticking down, he's not just this supremely competent guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's nervous.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't always do everything.
Yeah. A couple of things. First of all, he's as we get away from all the glitz and so on and look at him as an actor, he won the Oscar.
Yeah. 1986, The Untouchables.
Yeah. And he was witty enough to be able to solidify the best way to say his name. And that was Dr. No, 1962.
Mm-hmm.
I Am James Bond is scripted. Didn't feel good about that at all.
Yeah.
Then he did the Bond, James Bond, but he didn't pause it initially.
Hmm.
He finally figured out how it really worked, which was to have the pause.
Really?
I mean, you know, this is...
I didn't know that. That's so great. I love that. I love that. Yeah, you know, Bond, and for Connery, it certainly was, it was a restrictive role. At least it felt like that to him. He was trapped in his early stardom.
Could I read that quote?
Yeah, please.
This is what he said. I have always hated that damn James Bond. I'd like to kill him.
Yeah. It's kind of silly, though, right? To look that gift horse.
I know.
But, no, the thing was that early on, no one could foresee exactly how tightly he would grasp the public's imagination, how big it would become. I mean, it really was a kind of unforeseeable fortuity there. Like,
sure.
Of this character capturing the imagination of the world. Songs outside of the franchise were written. Product placement everywhere. It was really the first kind of taste of like that Star Wars kind of world that, mm-hmm. that we got later. So I could see how he might have felt as a great, competent actor that he was being held back by that.
Paving the way for Keanu Reeves.
Oh, all these people. Yeah. But here's the thing, is that more so than any other Bond, Moore, Brosnan, even Timothy Dalton, who was probably considered the greatest actor, you know, that time.
Which is...
Right, because he was Shakespearean, he had those chops. Connery proved himself and had a filmography outside of the Bond franchise that is incomparable to any of the Bonds, including Daniel Craig, who we now consider, I think, the best actors of the Bonds.
Okay.
But outside of the Bond franchise, Daniel Craig has very few great movies or really brilliant performances to point to. Mm-hmm. Maybe Layer Cake.
Yeah.
Knives Out, certainly.
Good one.
Knives Out is going to give him a life post-Bond.
Yes.
But Connery proved himself time and time again in movies like The Man Who Would Be King, The Wind and the Line, all the movies that he did with Sidney Lumet, The Offense, The Hill, The Anderson Tapes. I mean, this guy had a track record outside of...
We mentioned Untouchables.
The Untouchables,
for surely. Which he won the Oscar.
And Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade,
yeah.
You know, where he plays Indy's dad. So many great movies and roles outside of there. The Rock, even, is mm-hmm. such a fun mm-hmm. action movie. Yeah, he was just a great screen presence. You know, somebody on a podcast recently said... He was a great actor in as much as how skillfully he was able to transcend his own miscasting. I think that's sort of a backhanded compliment because I don't think necessarily, you know, they're talking about, I'm sure, in movies like The Wind and the Lion, where he's playing an Arab sheik, you know, or when, like, you know, and, I don't think that he's miscast. I don't think that somebody thought, you know, let's try to get away with casting Sean Connery as an Arab sheik. I think people just wanted to work with him. They knew how great he was, and they knew that he could, it didn't matter. You know, like The Hunt for Red October is a great example of that. He's playing a Russian sub commander. Does he ever once attempt a Russian accent?
No, he doesn't.
Who cares?
Look, you don't know how great he is? At the Paramount lunch place for executives only and A-list stars, he walked in. This is in the 60s. They all stopped when he walked in.
Mm-hmm.
He looked around. He said, "Oh, eat your lunch."
Yeah.
But can you imagine? For all the talents that were there, they stopped for him. And what, you know, what is that?
That's what I'm talking about. That brutish sophistication, when you couple that with the Bond icon,
mm-hmm.
it has to stop traffic, I would imagine.
And, you know, people were onto him for the kind of role because they had asked him to play the lead in the Thomas Crown Affair, and he turned it down.
Mm.
Which he regretted.
Probably because it was too close, right?
Yeah,
in tone.
Yeah.
One of the things that I like about him is what you're getting at. This, like, you know, look, let's not paint him a saint. He was, he had a lot of problems, you know. He was notoriously stingy about his money.
Well, isn't that funny? Because Grant was, too.
Right.
Yeah.
He sued everybody, apparently. Like, you know, he was constantly looking over every penny he earned. You know, that's obviously because he was born into impoverished circumstances. Mm. He had his first job when he was 9 years old. Can you imagine? So I'm sure that it meant that his success meant a great deal and he wanted to protect it. But he could be stingy. We knew he could be misogynistic, you know, which I guess he in later years disavowed. But he was a problematic figure in a lot of ways, but it was that little bit of him, that part of him that was rooted, that never forgot his Scottish working class roots, that he wasn't going to countenance that kind of, you know, starry-eyed nonsense. There was a couple of anecdotes. One I read where he was on the set of The Rock, directed by Michael Bay. And Connery noticed Michael Bay berating one of the lesser-known actors on set. So he walked up to him and he said, "Hey, why don't you go blow up a bridge?" You know, he was sticking up for the little guy, you know?
Lest you think that he's so self-possessed and so narcissistic, for his whole life, he would not wear a toupee except on film.
Oh, yeah, we got to talk about that. He was way ahead of the times there, right?
Yeah.
That is the other beautiful thing. He publicly, we knew he was bald or balding.
Yes.
But in the movies, he would only wear the toupee that was right for the role, sometimes wouldn't wear a toupee. You know, in some of those Lumette movies, he does not wear them. He only wore it if it was appropriate for the character.
Yeah.
I love the fact that this guy, this monument to male beauty, didn't succumb to that. I mean, that was 30 years before stars were comfortable doing that.
Yes.
You know, Travolta still wears a toupee.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Pathetically.
Yeah.
You know, and Connery was just so secure in his powerful looks and his own masculinity that he didn't care.
All right. Do you think he would care that the new James Bond is a female?
Well, you keep saying this. The new James Bond is not a female.
I was just poking you.
I know. It's not that. Just because there's an agent that has the 007 number in the new movie.
In the new movie.
The Broccoli's have said time and again, James Bond is a man. It will never be a woman.
Isn't that great?
It is great. It is great. In a, you know, because, look, we can reimagine characters as this and that.
Yeah.
It's silly, I think. It's silly and short-sighted to try to right wrongs of representation by just shoehorning or plugging in different sort of underrepresented groups into a role like this. I think, what's always been fun about James Bond, and Connery did this too, but it always changes with the actor, is watching James Bond react to the world, the changes in the world around him. You know, that's part of the character's allure. How will we reimagine Bond for today, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Look, men aren't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. The roles that we play might, and the roles, the way that they interact with the other human beings around them, that's going to change. And Bond is a reflection of that. We shouldn't lose that, I don't think. It's too much fun.
And I have to say, when I was growing up, I delighted in his sexism. Mm-hmm. And that's no longer, I'm not going to see that again.
Yeah, you won't see that again. You know, we don't need to see it again.
No.
And also at the time, it was, you know, we put too much stock in these fantasies, right? It was a fantasy of being competent. It's a competency fantasy about moving through the world in such a way that you're in control. And when you're not, you might regain it, you know, of being not tied down, right? Traveling the world. Yeah. It is a dream that doesn't exist in reality. And it's like saying, you know, it's like saying, I don't want to see Luke Skywalker with a lightsaber. It's so silly to think that, you know, we need that. But it did serve its purpose, I think.
And, you know, you've proven to me, for all the facets of Sean Connery in this role, I now see why his Italian fans called him Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Yeah.